Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of June 1st. And with me on a Saturday evening for a change is my partner, Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
Yeah, well, we were supposed to start at 11:15, but we squeaked in, so it's still Saturday.
We squeaked in? Okay. No, I think you were trying to squeeze through that window, buddy, by yourself.
Yeah, well, there was something like that, you know, about the camel fitting through the eye of the needle kind of thing, and that's me and time. So, yeah, well, we got in there, and I may have shed a few possessions along the way, but I got in under my imposed deadline, which was 45 minutes after yours.
Shed a few possessions along the way. All right. What you're trying to say is you dropped some of your crap trying to scramble in. But yeah, okay. I get it.
Hashtag
high heat. Okay.
All right. Thank you again to the frontline and essential workers worldwide. And we might think it's getting better and it might be getting better, but the fight is the same for all these people. So thank you very much. And, you know, from here, I'm going to stick to baseball, but America, you're really making it difficult for me, given my background, to stay silent. So, you know, let's be classy. All right, on this week's show, we've got Micah Franklin, former Nippon Ham and Tigers outfielder, and we've got opening day to look forward to. We're also going to reflect on last week's panel discussion, look at some of the data regarding managers, and handle some high heat. The bases are definitely loaded, so let's start swinging.
Okay, well, a week or so ago, I got in touch with Micah Franklin, an old buddy, one of the first people I interviewed here in Japan when I joined the Yomiuri 22 years ago.
Yeah, oh, you can't do that math easily, but you can.
No,
okay, whatever.
I cannot. No, it's hard. It's painful. Anyway, Micah then was a first-year player with the Nippon Ham Fighters, and he had a lot of difficulties with injuries and so on, and he was. He got off to a hot start, and you know his career kind of took a tumble from there. But he had a lot left in him. He went back to Indianapolis for a year after 2 years in Japan, played AAA there, and then he had a couple of years with the Hyundai Unicorns in the Korea baseball organization.
I bet you're trying to say Hyundai, but
well,
yeah, all right.
Hyundai, yeah. Not Hyundai. Apparently it's Hyundai. So Korean pronunciations are quite difficult for me because they're not the same as Japanese.
Right.
So I apologize to any Korean or Hangul listeners out there. Okay, now.
As do I.
We just assume so.
Listen here, late guy.
Okay. Well, Michael was kind of, you know, we talk about him and the steroid era and the analytics era and how he kind of got in between those two. And now the other thing I want to get on before we start is that, you know, I mentioned that he played all over the place, but when I was looking at his baseball reference page, I see that he played for the Single-A Hardware City Rock Cats. Now, you may not know where Hardware City is, but I mean either. It's the...
I thought it was that, you know, Ace is the place of the helpful hardware man place.
Well, it is. No, it's the it's New Britain, Connecticut, actually, is the nickname is Hardware City because apparently it's the... that's where the headquarters of Black & Decker is located.
Gotcha.
So they play...
That brings back memories.
Okay, well, the fun thing about that was when he was with the... Rock Cats, he was a teammate of future Bay Stars pitcher Shane Bowers, whom he was later a teammate he played against in Japan, and then whom he was later a teammate with for the Hyundai Unicorns.
Unicorns.
Okay, and some other guy named Torrey Hunter.
Ah, that's Torrey. Okay.
Yeah. So,
all right.
So let's have a listen to Micah Franklin give his story of his career in baseball in Japan. Our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast is former Nippon Ham Fighter and Hanshin Tiger and kind of all over the world guy, Micah Franklin. How you doing, man?
Man, really, really good. Enjoying a beautiful day here in Phoenix, Arizona. It's about 103 degrees. I hung out with my wife and my daughter as we're keeping safe, keeping our distance, and went swimming all day.
Yeah, all right. Well, I want to say, I want to go to Phoenix, and you guys get out of the pool, and I'll keep my distance in your pool.
Sounds good.
It would be nice, but no, we're not going anywhere. We're staying put here in Tokyo. And speaking of staying put, you didn't do a lot of that in your careers. You came from San Francisco, which is also my home territory, or I should say my mother's home territory. But you've been all over the place. Where's some of the best places you played, or most enjoyable places you played in your career?
By far, without a doubt, Japan would definitely being the experience of being in Tokyo and being in Osaka. Mm-hmm. When I played for the Tigers, we were in Rokko Island. Mm-hmm. That was unbelievable. I mean, being in Tokyo alone is unbelievable. Seoul was really, really cool to play in. And I got to experience a bunch of other countries. I got to enjoy Dominican Republic, and that was amazing. You know, spent a little time in Venezuela, a couple of tours in Mexico for a couple of winters, and got to enjoy Calgary, Canada. So, and then some spots in the States. So I got to enjoy a lot of places, but I love Japan. I really love that experience.
Yeah, you were, I was looking at your career and Baseball Reference, and I love Baseball Reference because all the trivia and this and that that pops up. But I guess one thing that really struck me is how much your game played everywhere in the world in terms of, you know, a guy who, you know, hit for some power and drew your walks. You had the on-base percentage going, you had the slugging average going. But you know, as we mentioned just before this, you know, you came along just before analytics probably would have given you maybe a more grounded in America game. Might have kept you in America longer.
Without a doubt. Unfortunately, the analytics weren't around like this when I played. And, you know, I was always a really high on base percentage guy, and I had powers. And there was years where my batting average wasn't as high. And right away, people look at batting averages. And people don't really realize it's only one or two hits a week. One hit a week in a major league season in the States, 26 weeks, that could be 50 points on your average. That's just one hit. And with me, when I got to 2-1, 3-1 counts, because I was a power hitter, pitchers just didn't throw the ball right over the plate. Mm-hmm. They still were very careful and walked me, so I took my walks and didn't chase, and that doesn't count as a hit, but it counts as on base percentage. So I had high on base percentage as an average, kind of went like a roller coaster sometimes.
It's ironic that, well, you know, an age plays a factor too, because you know, I know how it is in America. If you're in AAA and you're 20, you know, you're over 25, you know, the clock's ticking so loud you can hear it in your sleep. And especially if you're a slugger, because when you were 26 in Iowa, you had this 437 on base percentage. And I know it's AAA, but, you know, that was the average talking. I mean, that was higher than normal, but it was just an outstanding season. And then you're out. You're in Japan. So how was that the now, I guess what I really want to get to is, you know, how did you make those adaptations? How did you, you know, what inside you, or you know, what makes it what's the ability to adapt? What was it for you?
Well, you just mentioned I was in Iowa. That was a year after I played in the major leagues, and I did pretty decent for my chance up there. Mm-hmm. And it was during the steroid era, so I did really good in Iowa, but unfortunately there was a lot of players in the major leagues who were taking steroids.
All right.
And usually when you hit a certain age, mm-hmm. you your career, you kind of decline sure. in your numbers. Well, they didn't decline. Mm. They continued. So that year, we had guys who had 60-plus home runs in the major leagues, another right. guy 50. There's nowhere for you to go. So right. I was kind of stuck sandwiched. So those guys who it was their turn to for the new guys to come in and take their place, mm-hmm. That's kind of how the cycle of baseball works, right. you know? After a certain age, now the next group gets their chance, and the next group. Well, I got sandwiched into that group, so we didn't get our chance. So okay. the opportunity to go to Japan was there, and I jumped on it. And it, wow, what an experience for myself, my wife, my oldest daughter who went to school there, and it was great.
Now you had one of these. It was a really interesting year. We've talked about it before, but now let's. It was. Because I remember, you know, the red hot start you had when with the fighters, and we talked a lot about it, and things were, I don't know what it is. It's like sometimes you get that start and it's like never quite that way again. But again, the point is the batting average. You know, people look at the batting average and they go, huh. But instead of looking at, you know, 371, 400 on base percentage, they're going, how come this guy's only hitting 250?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had a couple of really bad times to get hurt in mm-hmm. my career. One of them was in Japan. So the last couple of days of April, I took a swing mm-hmm. and I didn't know what it was then, but it really, really hurt in my wrist. That year, I believe I had 6 to 7 cortisone shots to play the rest of the season. So every
was
time
that your
I
first, was that your second
missed,
year?
That was my first year.
First year.
My
okay.
first year.
Okay.
So after I swung and missed, I was in pain every single day. It hurt so bad. Oh. To the point where after I hit my 30th home run, it was about 4 or 5 games left in the season, and I shut it down to come home to have surgery.
Okay.
So I had surgery and a ligament, mm-hmm. and this is when the hammock bone was not really popular. They thought it was broken but wasn't sure, and they didn't want to do the surgery just in case. Well, unfortunately, I went back the next year, and they found out it was my hammock bone, because once I started swinging again, my wrist really, really hurt again.
Okay.
I got a hammock bone surgery. I came home, had the surgery, and because of the rules, you can only have 2 foreigners. We right. had 3 really good foreigners. Right. We had Nigel Wilson, myself, and Sherman Obando.
Right.
And they gave me a phone call and said, hey, the Hanshin Tigers would like to trade for you mm-hmm. if you're willing to try and play on it right away. Mm-hmm. Well, I was only 3 weeks into my surgery. That's usually about a 6-7 week recovery.
Okay.
And I came back and I did okay right away, but instantly I just couldn't. I couldn't play again. So I came back too soon. I ended up tearing a ligament that they fixed the year before, mm-hmm. the offseason before, and I was done for the year. And obviously I understand how Hanshin felt. I they traded for me and I didn't perform for them. And unfortunately, they let me go at the end of the year. And then again in Korea, my second year, I ran into a wall. I tore my labrum and rotator cuff. So 2 times in my career that I really didn't want to get hurt, that I mm-hmm. could have had a decent opportunity overseas, I got hurt. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I want to ask about, and I'm going to try to get specific, because in your career you've been – okay, you've adapted to foreign countries as a hitter, and then you also coached, and now you're scouting. So I'm going to ask about what is it that made you able to make those adjustments? Because you come to Japan, and there's a cultural adjustment, there's an off-field adjustment, there's a noise in the crowd adjustment, there's different pitches, there's different pitchers, there's different ways of playing baseball, there's lots of distractions, if you let them be distractions. So what was the, if, I mean, in hindsight, what did you do well? And I guess what I want to get to is, how do you help people develop those skills and 3, now that you're a scout, how do you spot that ability in players? Well, I'm sorry, that's a big load. But
No, not at all. Number one was easy because I grew up in San Francisco.
Okay.
A multicultural environment, which is really, really easy growing up in San Francisco to really get to have an opportunity to experience different cultures. Mm-hmm. So that part was easy. And then you go off at 18 years old, I got drafted by the Mets and I got sent to Kingsport, Tennessee, which is not a multicultural environment. So that was actually harder for me than it was going to other countries to play.
Mm.
Trying to adapt to people who were maybe some close, small-minded versus, you know, different cultures. So that was interesting, you know.
Okay.
Then as I gone into scouting, I went into coach and then scouting, and I had the opportunity, it was awesome, to go to Korea and then in Japan where me and you had breakfast,
right?
Which was awesome, watching Ohtani and the All-Star game and other things and really have those experiences and truly enjoy them, not just go there and have an assignment, but actually love that experience. And believe it or not, now I'm back coaching. I'm back in the uniform in the minor leagues coaching again. So, I love every one of the experiences. Well, I guess I'm not coaching right now. We're shut down, but hopefully we'll be back soon. But yeah, so now I'm a hitting coach back with the Diamondbacks and just enjoying coaching players from all over the U.S. and all over countries. We have players from all different countries, different backgrounds, and I really enjoy the experience to get to know those guys.
Okay, well, I just want to wrap this up. Thank you for being a guest on our podcast. It was long overdue and hopefully won't be so long in the future before we have you back again.
Well, it was awesome. I enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll get back together, and maybe one day I'll back there in Japan and we'll have breakfast together.
Oh, man. I look forward to that.
Okay, buddy. Thanks so much for joining us. We were kind of rushed. We were put on the clock by the Arizona Diamondbacks. I'm not bashing you guys because you got me the interviews and they got done.
All right. And that's that. Thank you. That's all I heard was thank you.
Yep. That was it. I appreciate them. They didn't have to. And they've got about a zillion guys who played in Japan in the Diamondbacks organization. So from the manager to one of the senior consultants to half a dozen guys around the minor league. So it's a lot of fun. Anyway, so John, what did you take from Mr. Franklin's story?
Yeah, I don't think I got to see him play. I went on the internet. Yeah, I looked him up but the chat was fun. You guys sounded really chummy and that was really nice. And this is exactly the kind of discussion we don't get to hear about when a guy is active. You know, you don't hear about, well, I have a pain in my wrist and I don't know what it is and I'm going to try to play through it and I'm going to go back home and have surgery and come back and another team's going to give me a chance, but they want me to play right away. That team wants me to play right away and I'm going to try to do that, but there's too much pain. And, you know, we don't get that part of the story. What we get is, here's a guy who comes to Japan and we assume he's just not able to make the adjustment. Things are too difficult. He can't produce. He gets sent to the farm and he just disappears or he's injured or we hear about the injury. We don't, you know, we hear about the guy hopping back on a plane and going back home to see doctors in the States, blah, blah, blah. You know, we've heard this story a long time. And so it was really good to hear the backstory and get the information that it was a hamate, but even at that time, the hamate wasn't a well-known thing.
Mm.
So he knew that there was just pain and they had to figure it out. And it just, you know, hearing him go through an entire off season and come back and then not be able to play because, you know, it's still damaged. That is the part that's really sad. So like I said, I guess, you know, a lot of times I say this, but we definitely don't have all the information that managers have. And it doesn't even sound in this case like the manager had all the information or if it did, it wasn't a big priority, mm-hmm. because this is, as Alonzo Powell said last week on the show, you're a hired gun, mm-hmm. and you got to fire whatever bullets you have. So, you know, you got whatever bullets you have, some might be blanks, unfortunately, and makes a lot of noise, but you know, not a lot of production. So, when guys are unable to meet expectations, this is what happens. So I was glad we were able to get that story, because, you know, we come here, well, you and I always, whenever I meet the players at the ballpark and they say, how am I doing? I always say, hey, I don't have to throw it and I don't have to hit it, so I'm doing fine. And because, you know, they've got to do those things. They've got to, you know, the pitchers have to get it, get outs, and the batters have to get hits, and there's a lot of pressure to do all that. And you hear about the fan experience for the players now that we're going to have games, hopefully, that are going to be in empty stadiums. But you hear how much the fan part of it is important. But, you know, this is the part that the fans don't get to hear. So I was really happy to hear that part of the story and get some context to his experience here. And a lot of times we just talk about, or we end up talking to guys who either had a very successful career here or they're fairly well known. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think in this case that was the case with Michael Franklin. And so it was really fun.
Yeah, it was. And one of the things that were kind of, I remembered, what I didn't remember was that I had a bunch of his data. That I have it now. You know, I have his, like, the batting
stolen.
Well, let's not go down that road. But anyway, I have a bunch of it. I have a bunch of box scores from his career, and it hadn't occurred to me that I did. I forgot about them because I don't remember the old years, but I do have 1999 and 2000 loaded in my database. And it's like I remember he got off to this red hot start we talked about. It was 1999. And he had, through May, he had 11 home runs, like, in April with a mm-hmm. 409 on base percentage. And I'm thinking, okay, he's got it figured out. And then it was like that was through May. And then from the rest of the season, it was like, ouch. It was like a 212, you know, 326 on base. He had 18 home runs in the remaining 83 games, which was fine. But his slugging average was 327. It was just horrid. He just, you know, he just fell right off the table. And at the time he told me, he didn't tell me anything about, of course, he didn't know it was a hamate bone, but he was in pain, right. But he didn't tell me about it. He told me his, shall I say, excuse, he's my friend, but, you know, people make excuses.
Reason.
He said, yeah, his rationale for that was that pitchers had tried to pitch him. As soon as the season started, everybody came inside.
Mm.
And this gives a lot of foreign players trouble at first because they're not used to the Japanese strike zone, which is essentially the rule book strike zone horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's not one ball width on the inside of the plate is still a strike. In MLB, it used to be if it was the ball was not completely over the plate on the inside, it was a ball. And they moved it outwards to keep batters from getting hit. So anyway, a lot of the foreign players, when they first came here, the imported players, had trouble with inside pitches. But his explanation was that was his sweet spot.
Uh-huh.
At the time.
At the time, or before the injury.
Correct. And they moved away from that. So they stopped throwing him inside when they figured he was turning on all those puppies. They adjusted to him was his answer. And then, so I didn't know he was injured, but I remember him telling me about that. He referred to the 2016 breakfast we had when he told me he was going to be in Japan. I didn't know, you know, I figured he was just like always in Japan, you know, like these guys come and go all the time. It was one of the rare times. So anyway, yeah, that was kind of fun.
Can you imagine that though? Can you imagine having I've never obviously broken the hamate, but I had a fracture in a thumb playing basketball, and I for 2 months, not knowing what it was, I just taped it and I kept going back. It was my left thumb, so it was on my non-shooting hand, but although I did shoot with my left hand a lot, but in close. And playing baseball with that injury, you know, and going through it's not the games, it's got to be the practice, man. It has to be the practicing and all that goes with it. And I don't know how long he played with it like that. That is just, it just sounds excruciating
to me. The cortisone, the shots reminded me of what happened to Michelle Abreu with the Fighters, who had this dynamite first season or first half of the season. And then the artificial turf just got to him, just demolished his lower back. And he just couldn't play without shots until he couldn't take any shots anymore.
Okay,
I don't know, but the turf at Tokyo Dome used to be pretty hard. So I didn't know that story, but the other thing that really got to me, or I guess now I've heard last time or a couple of weeks ago, Rick Short told us, you know, he was in that steroid era where everybody was hitting for power. And so that was one thing. Of course, he wasn't going to hit for power anyway, but there were a lot of little guys, you know, people taking steroids who were hitting for, you know, looking like Brady Anderson all of a sudden. And I had heard Marty Brown had told me that the reason he ended up in Japan was because he had a wife and kids and didn't want to take steroids. And he lost his job at third base coming up in the Cincinnati Reds organization to Spuds McKenzie. What's his name? Chris Sabo.
Yeah, with the Cincinnati Reds right. In the 80s. Yeah. Yeah,
because he wore the glasses. They called him Spuds. So he didn't want to do that because of his family, put his family at risk. So he lost his job because he wasn't going to take steroids. But this was an interesting one because Mike is one, you know, he was, so his story was he was playing behind guys who were older, but who were like the thing that wouldn't die. It was like a horror movie. These guys are the guy who wouldn't. The players who wouldn't decline, you know, what are these 35-year-old guys playing like they're 27? What's going on here? You know, better living through chemistry. So that was his story. And also he was a guy who had huge on base percentages in the minors. And he was, and it was in an era when it was underappreciated. As soon as that steroid era was ending, it was when people were, you know, when people were looking at on base percentage and going, I should say teams were looking at, a lot of people were looking at it before that. But so he also got caught in between and then had rotten luck, but he did get to see every place in the world practically.
Right. Yeah. And get paid to do it. It wasn't like he was just there on vacation. So that's good.
No.
But yeah, it's just like we talk about the competition for positions, but again, talking about backstory, this is the portion that that we don't always hear, which is some guy has in this case, it was a serious injury, but some guy has an injury that he's also fighting through as he, you know, he battles to try to grab a position from somebody. And just because you win the position doesn't mean you can keep it. You have to produce. And, you know, you talked about the hit per week. A lot of people have, I think we've heard, and I think it was made famous by a movie. I think wasn't it the Slugger's Wife?
Bull Durham. Yeah,
it was Bull Durham, not the Slugger's Wife. Okay, all right, I don't remember
that. Slugger's Wife.
It was way back in the '80s, something around there. But anyway, but the thing is, you know, he said, "Hey, look, I was getting on base. You know, it was just not a hit." People just want to stare at the batting average, but. You know, you've got that, and then you've got injuries and making constant adjustments to stay up in the game. And the good thing about Japan is you get to play a lot of the same players and pitchers. You get to face them over and over again, but that can also be bad because they know your weaknesses as well. Mm. So Yeah, it was really fun. Really fun.
It was fun. He's, you know, I'm glad that he's, you know, he's getting to, well, if they ever play a season, he doesn't have to go far. He lives in Phoenix.
Okay.
And yeah, he's just the nicest guy. He didn't quite introduce me to CC Sabathia, but he told me a story. Micah told me about how he used to go up with to Vallejo, a little north of San Francisco, and trained with Chris Latham and CC Sabathia and so on. And so because he told me about that crowd, and he told me that Chris was friends with CC, and when I was in New York two Septembers ago, I had a chance to just say, you know, to introduce myself to CC, and he's a very large man, and he's very imposing, but he's a real sweet gentleman, you know, just a real joy. And that was because Micah told me about that. So it was thanks to him that I had that experience. So Micah, I appreciate it always.
And I know Vallejo very well. I have cousins who are living up there. Oh. So shout out to Sharon and Leanne. How you doing, guys?
Okay.
Been there a number of times. Wow.
Who would have thought?
Yes, who would have? All right. While we're thinking about that, we'll make a four-seam transition and talk about opening day. So I'm thrilled to have baseball coming. MBB announced a week ago on Monday that June 19th is the date it has set as a firm target to start something resembling.
I think it's kind of a moving target, actually. They're trying to keep it down, but I think it's probably still potentially a moving target.
It is not like Rocky trying to catch a chicken, but
from the movie. Okay, I was thinking.
The movie, that's correct.
The flying squirrel. Okay, okay.
Oh, hey, Rocky. No. Practice games are going to ramp up this week, and we know now. This is as far as I heard. I didn't follow all the reports. I was kind of busy at work this past week, but. I know that the Central League has shot down the notion of a playoff series, but the PL has not yet nixed it. So we'll keep an eye out for that. I haven't seen anything yet.
I've seen the reason I haven't seen the hard decision on it yet, but I think the CL is going, look, we've got more outdoor stadiums. It's going to be colder than, you know, cold. And we don't know what's going to happen.
From what I've seen, the schedule that they're going to put together, which is not really done yet, but they're going to use six games a week, and that's a hard and fast schedule to the end. And the Japan series is scheduled for November 21st, so they're not going to have a lot of time to make up rainouts and all that other stuff. And so I was thinking that we might see a doubleheader at some point if they want to get the games in this year. But this is just going to be such an abnormal year that maybe they're going to say, you know what, if you're out of the playoff picture and you don't get your games in, nobody's playing a full schedule, so don't worry about it. Sit back and rest up for the, you know, for spring, for what is it, fall baseball, which is already supposed to have started probably by then, right?
Indeed.
So that's the plan. I can foresee some of these rainouts, though, really playing havoc with this plan. But having a plan is better than not having a plan, as you have said many, many moons ago on this show. So I'm thrilled that we're going to be able to see some of the rookies play this year, because I was talking to somebody at the office maybe a couple weeks ago, and I said, hey, look, if none of these rookies gets out there on the field this season, there's going to be a ton of rookies next year.
Indeed.
Because they're going to draft guys. And, we were discussing the draft situation as well. And I just thought, you got two times as many rookies that you would normally have, and you got to figure out how to get them at bats and get them some experience and blah, blah, blah. And speaking of rookies, I did see that Tadahito Iguchi of Lotte, the manager, has not yet ruled out rookie pitcher Noki Sasaki for a spot on the first team when the season starts. And that doesn't surprise me, even though we've had 3 months go by when the season was supposed to have started. And I figured he would pitch on the top team this season because we can already see just in practicing and the practice footage that I've seen that he can throw better than some of the farm team pitchers already. So all he's going to do down there on the farm is possibly get some experience facing pro batters. Well, he has done that for 3 months, so it wouldn't be surprising for me to see him. But I'm just excited that there's going to be some baseball, hopefully. We just really have to stay vigilant. People, stay inside. This thing is not over yet. Just because they lifted the state of emergency doesn't mean it's time to go out and play.
Yeah, let's get rid of that emergency. Yeah, well, yeah, the thing with Sasaki was it's Saturday now, and on Thursday, Iguchi was saying, I don't think he's going to be able to make the practice games in June, and now he's going, today he's saying, oh, yeah, It's like, when did Iguchi become Hiromitsu Ochiai? You know, like, I was just lying to you guys all along. Didn't you figure it out?
Yeah. Probably when management came down and said, hey, dummy, stop making these statements that are definite statements here. Just be vague.
Indeed. So we're going to, so June 19th is the day, and they're putting together the list of, you know, the guidelines, which is kind of interesting. You know, how are they going to keep the players safe? And the one point that struck me is all along that NPB has been really good about reading the room. After, you know, it's like when they started announcing new opening days in March, they were following the government's lead. Oh, there's going to be Olympics in July. So let's just have, if there's going to be an Olympics in July, we can start the season on March 24th, you know, or March, you know, April 10th or whatever.
And or whatever pie in the sky date it was.
Exactly. You know, it's like, well, if July, and as soon as they said the Olympics were gone, then they started being suitably vague about it. And as soon as they got into the state of emergency, you know, they started talking about a state of emergency, they're going, well, we don't know. And then on the 25th, when they announced that the season was going to start on the 25th of May, they said, we haven't even thought about fans in the stand. We've been so busy just trying to figure out how to organize games behind closed doors because our priority is safety. And then the next day it comes out, oh, we want to have 2,000 fans in the stands by July 4th. okay. Yeah. It's like, are we done acting like we care? I'm being mean, but I'm just saying.
No, you're being accurate, and you wrote a post about it on your blog. Yeah. And although I didn't get to read all of it, there was a great line in it, and I encourage you guys to go to J Ball Allen and check it out. It was a really good post, and yeah, it doesn't make sense. And you know, at first they were talking about, yeah, it's all about fan safety and fans, and we have to be careful about this thing. And now they're trying to figure out how to get money.
But, you know, the interesting thing is that they, you know, it hasn't been, we haven't had people being furloughed. We haven't had players not being paid.
Correct.
We haven't had talks with the union about cutting salaries. Now, the one thing we haven't heard anything about has been conspicuously absent is service time. And no one. Well, I don't know. You know, I'm thinking the owners are going to say, well, look, tough, whatever, you know, tough spigot.
Tuffy.
Yeah. Tough spigot there, babies. You're not getting a full year of service time added on to that pre, you know, that's that time you know, leftover time from when you were 24 years old 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, that'll be a good talking point to get Don Nomura on the show again and talk to him about in the offseason because, yeah, it doesn't seem – to me, if the season is going to be 120 games and you play the 120 games or the equivalent of whatever percentage you need to get service time, then you should get a full season because that's what the season is going to be. That's just me. Yeah, I'm just a dude looking over the fence.
I think I would prorate it this year because, well, 100, if you play all – if you're on the roster for the whole season, you'll get your days in. That's not a problem. But it's very tight. And there will be some owners who are likely saying, oh, good.
Good, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying about the notion of baseball being played again. And
yeah.
Again, I don't know. I can't imagine what it's going to be like going to a game, but I'm in the let's say, preliminary stages of getting finagling my way to the ballpark on June 19th somewhere.
Did you hear? Tokyo. Did you see the one about techniques or the countermeasures to prevent the COVID-19 infections, to limit them?
All I know is you have to have a mask. You have to get your temperature taken to enter the ballpark as a media member. After that, I didn't hear anything.
Yeah, I'm just assuming they're still considering it, but no going on the ground, no going on the field, no going in the dugout, not standing next to players, and staying 2 meters away from other reporters in the media areas.
Yeah.
So in other words, don't you know, watch from a distance, watch from a safe distance, which, you know, I can sympathize with, but it's going to be I think we're going to be doing is when we see you ball players at the park, we'll, you know, make sure we get your contact info, put it on that piece of paper and leave it there, and I'll pick it up and then we'll do it by phone.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have an iPhone and an iPod, and I was just thinking I'll carry one in a plastic bag that they can take out of the plastic bag, and from 2 meters away, I'll ask the questions and they can record it on the iPod. That was my plan, but we'll see.
It's going to take
some time. Yeah, I think it's going to be different with each team, too.
Yeah.
Some teams more vigilant and
I think they might be putting the bars up at Yokohama Stadium.
#high heat.
All right, let's make a two-team transition, get away from Yokohama, and just reflect on the panel discussion that we had last week. And I'd like to, again, take the time to thank Marty Kienert, the former Rakuten GM, and then Chunichi batting coach Alonzo Powell, and Cebu ace Zach Neal for joining us last week and really providing listeners with some great insights, some anecdotes, some in-depth analysis.
Hey, forget about the listeners. I learned a bunch of stuff. Sorry, listeners. My priorities are me.
Well, you were actually part of the panel, and I was the moderator. I'm not sure that people really followed along. I think they thought it was interviews, and so that's really not the case. It was a panel discussion, so you were part of the panel's discussion. So thank you very much as well, Jim. And we can't thank those guys enough, though. And I listened to the show at least 3 times. I don't even want to admit. I mean, I partially listened to it another time, so. And that was after going through the whole thing and fine tuning. So one of my favorite stories was Marty just talking about early on, he was just spitting fire through the whole show, but him talking about the tie-ups with major league teams, just being stupid and talking about the fact that Hanshin signed a player who was injured and showed up at the airport on crutches. I just couldn't believe how funny and how entertaining that part was. And then Alonzo's story with him working out with guys the likes of Chili Davis and Jeffrey Leonard and even Willie Mays when those guys were with the Giants in the 1980s. And Zach talking, and Zach went 4 scoreless innings on Friday in an inter-squad game, so he looks sharp. Zach talking about his involvement or evolvement as a pitcher and collecting pitches as he's gone along, you know, and throwing 1,400 innings in his career. It was just all really entertaining, really informative.
Yeah, you know, I think that line about finding out who I was as a pitcher was great. And, you know, the thing that I loved, I think, one of the things I really, really enjoyed was one of Marty's stories about the change-up in Japan. When I came to Japan, the change-up was pretty rare. It was actually pretty rare until about 15 or 16 years ago, and Daisuke Matsuzaka started throwing one, and it kind of caught on a bit. And it's been incremental.
Mm-hmm.
Until a lot, I would say probably a third of the pitchers in Japan throw a changeup now, but probably 20 years ago it was about 5%. And the one thing that got to me was talking about Don Blasingame. And now this is the late Don Blasingame is a guy I never met. He died when I was working for the Yomiuri, but his son Kent is a scout for the SoftBank Hawks. The elder Blasingame, is one of these guys who had a huge impact on how baseball was played in the game, along with Wally Onamine, who's in the Hall of Fame, and later Daryl Spencer. They were not, you know, well, Onamine was a huge player in terms of his impact, but these other guys weren't, you know, they were good players, but it was more like, in the case of Don Blasingame, it was a more of the way he looked at the game, his sort of tactical approach. He and the late Katsuya Nomura were two peas in a pod. They were basically, when Nomura became the Hawks player manager, I think in 1972 or 1973, and Blasingame was like his consigliere, or wingman or whatever. But these two guys were like really, really cunning and crafty.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had that going. They built on what was going on with the Hawks and the data and the analysis and some of the shenanigans. There were shenanigans and, you know, sign stealing and whatnot. And they were kind of famous for that. And analyzing video and whatnot. And Blasingame then went on to be a coach with the Hiroshima Carp, and he was also he had a large influence on how the Carp style, that speed and defense, pitching and defense, base running and good fielding style came about. So to hear him talk about that was just a real thrill.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. So, and part of the show, making a seamless transition, part of the show included our talk about what positions make the best manager. So we didn't have really much time to evaluate those numbers. But, you know, the good thing about Jim Allen is if you point him in the direction.
There is one good thing, and I dare you to find it.
Right, yeah. If you point him in the direction and you give him a little bit of a boost or a kickstart, you know, he'll go the distance for you. as long as you can get control of that mouth. But anyway, that's the impossible part, right? We kid because we love to kid. where are we?
Yeah, I'm sure we do.
All right, so we really didn't have much time to evaluate the numbers, but we didn't also have all the numbers from 1950 either. And so apparently Jim spent a whole off day, I'm hoping.
Pretty much.
going and getting the rest of the numbers and putting that whole database together. And so now it's complete?
Yeah, it's basically every guy who's managed a game in NPB. Since 1936. Well, wow. Before it was NPB. There may be a few guys who are acting managers who were not listed, you know, who got missed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I got a lot of those guys.
All right.
Okay. So question number one is which managers with 500 plus games have the highest winning percentages?
What positions?
Oh, what positions are they?
Yeah, what positions are the manager? I don't know. I had things in my head that I wanted to do that I had part of the database, but I had it on Excel and I kept trying to make it, you know, I kept trying to filter things out and have it give me the the answer, but it wouldn't. I wanted to know, for instance, the Giants managers, who was the most successful Giants manager, who has been the least successful Giants manager, things like that. I wanted to get, but it wouldn't let me filter all those things out. So I couldn't do it.
I haven't quite gotten to that stage. I need to build another table.
Yeah, we've got the data now. We can play with it.
I keep adding summary tables to this thing, and it'll pop that stuff
out. Right.
So anyway, I did spend about 10 minutes figuring out categorizing these managers by the position at which they played the most games in their career.
Okay.
And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to give you a list. I'm going to run down the positions from 1 to 10 of the top 10. The positions that he played. Okay, number one, the first two are Hawks managers. The first one's a third baseman, and he's the all-time managing win percentage in Japanese baseball history was Kazuto Tsuruoka, Hall of Fame manager of the Nankai Hawks. Third baseman. I thought he was a second baseman, but third baseman. Okay. Next, Kimiyasu Kudo, pitcher.
Wow. That's what I was going to guess is I'm sorry to interject, but when I talked to Dennis Sarfate and he sent me a long response, that was part of it. He said a lot of it is context. Mm. Sometimes a manager steps into a position in which he only has to take a team that's capable of winning and not mess it up, or take a team that's on the verge of winning and help push it over into that winning situation. Or you get managers who are in rebuild situations or middle of the pack situations. So there's a lot of context and nuance to it all.
Yeah, well,
so it's not that simple that this guy's a better manager and that guy's a better manager just because if you're counting the wins.
Right.
So I thought about that. And what Alonzo said last week when he was trying to guess, presented the question to them, I said, try to guess. And he was just thinking, okay, well, I'm going to go with the successful teams. And so he started talking about, guys like, I think he was thinking of Tatsunori Hara of the Giants because he has been in a good situation and practically every year that he has been there. So context is part of it. And that was why I was going to say Kudo, because he just has been winning and has been so fortunate with his situation that he has obviously added to it, in my opinion, but he certainly walked into something good. It wasn't like he jumped into a jalopy. He was driving a Ferrari, and all he had to do is put gas in and keep it on the road.
Well, that's also a little probably slightly misleading because, I mean, yeah, true.
Yes.
He's in a great situation, and he's also on the low side of the samples with 700. I mean, he trails Tsuruoka by one winning percentage point, but Tsuruoka managed close to 3,000 games.
I would say that Kudo has gone out and gotten some new wheels for his ride. He's redone the interior. He's rebuilt the carburetor of a Ferrari.
All that matters is whether it's got rims.
But he is making improvements on the car. It's not like he's taking it and running it into the ground. So, he's doing a good job.
Okay, number three is Tetsuharu Kawakami, who would have been a Hall of Famer from his playing days, but he managed 9 straight Japan Series wins with the Yomiuri.
And that's why I was going to pick him first, but I didn't. And you didn't even let me get a chance to guess. You just start rattling them off because I didn't look. I don't have this data. I was going to try to guess, but you ruined it for me. Thanks.
Okay, next is a pitcher.
You feel bad about it, will you please? I'll give you some money.
If there's money involved, okay, I feel bad. Do I still feel bad?
How long is this going to take?
Okay, anyway, so the next one's a Giants manager who is a pitcher. That should be a gimme, but you weren't here then, so maybe not. Motoshi Fujita, also in the Hall of Fame, primarily as a manager, also former Giants ace.
Mm-hmm.
The next is a manager who spent most of his career with the Giants.
Okay, you're going to have to give us numbers, though, now.
We're talking about numbers as in he was a third
baseman. You started with number one.
Okay, and he's number five.
Number five, okay.
And it's a Shigeru Mizuhara, who was Kawakami's predecessor as Giants manager.
Okay.
And then he went on to have success with three or four other teams. Okay, then the next one is really a shock because we talked about guys who had played. All these guys had really good teams to work with. Well, Soroka rebuilt his team over and over and over again. So, but this guy, I was shocked because the first two guys are Hawks managers. The next three are Giants managers. This guy was a manager of a team that was really pretty bad through most of its existence, the Chunichi Dragons. And this was a guy named Shunichi Amachi. And he managed the Dragons, I think, in the early 40s. When they were kind of one of the weak sisters, but he was a catcher and had a very respectable winning percentage for a team that was otherwise quite weak.
Now he's number six, and you're not giving us any of the winning percentages.
Okay, 582. Next at 574, a guy who's in the Hall of Fame as a manager. Actually, pretty much all these guys are in the Hall of Fame as managers. Another catcher, a Giants catcher. Mm-hmm. Who managed the Cebu Lions? Should be a giveaway. Masaaki Mori.
Mori.
Known as, okay, so he's in a hole. Nope. He was a. Okay, next, Tatsunori Hara.
And what's he at?
Winning percentage. He is at number eight.
He's at number eight, but what's the winning percentage?
Winning percentage 569. These guys are all pretty compacted. It's really. Not much. He's won 1,024 games. He's still looking for 1,025.
Okay.
Okay. Next is a new guy. In fact, a new former manager, Koichi Ogata.
Wow.
Wow. Indeed. Surprise.
Huh. Surprise. Yeah. He's got enough to qualify. He's got 515
games. he managed five seasons, once before they were in the playoffs and once after.
Wow. Okay. Good job for three.
Yeah, well, he won three championships in 5 years, so pretty good.
That's a lot of stress. Yeah, yeah. I see why he left.
Next is
doing all this winning and you guys are complaining?
Okay, number 10 is a favorite of mine. If you have a chance, look up the career of Wataru Nonin. He's just a remarkable individual. He was not a professional baseball. He was barely a professional baseball player, but he managed and had a huge influence on a lot of people who became greats in the game. So,
where is Katsuya Nomura?
That's a good question. Where is Katsuya Nomura?
Because I thought he was going to be really way up high, and then I realized, he had some struggles. For a while, and then he had some struggles with the Swallows before they got good, and then with Rakuten they didn't really win.
Nomura is okay. Hold on, let me just do this sort again because he's 500 even.
Yeah, 500 even. That's amazing. Because I just had this image of him winning so many games.
Well, he won. If you do it based on how many pennants they won, he won three Japan series. So. That's something, but hold on. How far down is he? Two catchers have 500 winning percentages. Tsutomu Ito and Katsuya Nomura.
Wow.
Although Nomura has won 1,565 games, which is fifth most in NPB history.
Right. Wow. Wow, and what was the top winning percentage again?
609. By the all-time winning manager in Japan, Kazundo Tsuruoka, who was Nomura's first manager.
That's cool. Well, we've got this database, so we look forward to your questions about positions.
No, we don't.
And well, Jim does. I don't have the data. All right. One note, Shintaro Fujinami of the Hanshin Tigers was late to practice and dropped to the farm. And gosh, that's why I didn't want to pick this team to finish first, because I figured the Tigers would mess it up because they have a lot of things lined up to where they could, looks like they could be really good. And yet things happen. Stuff happens, even Fujinami happens. So, yeah, great. Yikes.
Yeah, he was. He looked really good. He looked pretty good when he pitched in February, the beginning of March. But oh well, you got to be on time.
Yeah, you got to be on time. So, manager said, yeah, take a good look at yourself, son. So, let's go to fielding questions. So, we've got two questions this week, both about the draft. Pete, we will get to your
third base
question about infielders and third baseman next week, and then we'll wrap it up with shortstops and second baseman. I think we'll just do them both at the same time, because we're going to get into the season. So anyway, the first question is an MP3, and it comes from Gabe in Toronto.
Hello, John and Jim. Hope you're keeping well during these pandemic times. I stumbled upon a video of the 2018 NPB draft, and the format of the first round really intrigued me. It also made for good television with the suspense before the contested picks are resolved. My question is, why did NPB set up the first round format like that? Thanks for continuing to do the podcast, guys. Take care.
All right, man. How come everybody has a better mic than I do and a better voice?
Can we get Max and Gabe and just give the show to them?
Yeah, Max, Gabe, you guys do it. We'll feed you the lines.
People be tuning in just to listen to your voices. I mean, with me, they'd be looking for the mute button.
All right, so that's a question about the draft. And then Paul in Calgary, we got so many Canadian people. This is beautiful. Checking out the show. Paul in Calgary sent an email, and he says, thanks for keeping the pod going. Look forward to it every weekend during this long Calgary lockdown. You mentioned the draft last week being a couple of weeks ago, and I was wondering how teams have strategized. Have teams generally all taken a chance at getting that number one guy, or have others been more conservative and picked a guy a little bit down the board in order to avoid the lottery with several other teams? Seems like a good draft system that would eliminate the tanking issues that plague MLB. Or are there any other shenanigans I'm not aware of that make this system problematic? So very similar questions. Let's go with Gabe's first and talk about the way they do the first round.
Well, they didn't always used to do the first round, though. I mean, they used to do all the rounds that way. Every round where, you know, it used to be, and I say that because the draft has been through so many different versions, and I just don't want to go into it and all. I mean, I'm going to eventually explain that somewhere, because I'll run out of things to explain someday, and I'll go, time for the draft.
Right.
That's the way it works. And
that's the way it is. Yeah.
But basically they settled on the first round lottery after a lot of the draft trouble, after the, you know, usually every time there's a scandal, the draft changes. That's pretty much what motivates it. Now, why do they have the lottery? They instituted the lottery very early, because the purpose of the draft is not to make weak teams good, but to make rich teams, to keep rich teams rich.
Yes, and that, way back, it was the very first year of the show, and Jim and I were talking about the purpose of the draft, and I whined and ranted about this draft not being draft to help competitive balance, and that it more often than not helps the rich get richer and keeps the talent away from the poorer teams or the low budget teams or the teams that need the talent the most. It's very frustrating. And so I just didn't like it, but please continue, because we have more to talk about.
Well, I just keep it real short. It was, it was to keep, at that time, the Giants were not, you know, when they set this system up, the Giants were not the defending Central League champions. The Hanshin Tigers were in 1964, but that was the year the Giants won their first Japan series, the first of nine in a row. And the Giants didn't want to, you know, they were one of the stronger teams. They didn't want to be one of the worst, you know, they were typically finishing first or second. typically finishing first and then second some years. And they didn't want to be the, you know, the 10th or 11th or 12th team picking every year. And since the Giants pretty much wrote the rules, that wasn't going to happen. So they put in the draft. They put in the lottery. And they've had a variety of different versions of it. And then when the lottery didn't work, then they introduced another system where the teams could basically negotiate with players outside the draft. And then
lies the shenanigans.
And then then more shenanigans followed, and that changed. And then more further shenanigans followed, and that changed. And then other scandals happened, and it changed again. And that's where we are now.
Yeah, we've had money under the table, big money teams just bombing smaller market teams by talking to players ahead of the draft and saying, look, you know, we're going to draft you. Don't even talk to this other team and don't get meetings. And I don't know, there's other ways that they've tried to circumvent rules, and there's been a lot of shenanigans going on. So
I did have,
there might not be any.
I just to add to that, Mr. Nagano, who's a longtime secretary general of the Central League, told me recently, we had lunch, and he said, you know, how come it is that Central League teams, you know, what's wrong with the Central League? You know, as we often talk about, how come they're so lame? And he said, well, look, basically when the Giants tell the Central League teams that they're going to draft a guy, other Central League teams are afraid to draft him. They don't want to make the Giants angry.
No way.
Which is why so often it's like the Nippon Ham Fighters of the other team trying to draft a guy with the Giants. It's never a Central League team.
Man up.
Indeed.
Go get your player. So, I've always despised this draft system, but hey, look, competitive balance. You seem like last year in the draft, we had teams that needed good talent, get good talent. So I'm happy with the results, but it's just, you know, I don't know that there's any perfect system out there. And this notion of tanking, meaning, from my definition, intentionally losing so you can end up in a good draft position to build, I just don't know how that works in baseball, because you need to have players develop most of the time. And not many step right in from high school and start playing. So if you're going to do that and draft a college player, then he's a little bit older. So I don't know if there's a perfect scenario in which you want to tank for a particular player. I'm happy with this system. Whatever. I would like to see a little bit less drama. And guys, we had 3 years ago, was it? The Mitsuru Manaka thinking he had drafted, gotten the first pick.
Shin Takayama. That's right.
Yeah. And it turns out he made a mistake.
He didn't know what the winning lot looked like. He got they all have an end. It's like they all say, you know, this is official NPB. This is your official NPB failure. But the winning one has like the reds. They have to show them now. This is what the winning one looks like. Don't be a doofus. Don't be a Monaka.
Try not to. Don't be a Monaka. Try not to be.
I like Monaka-san, so I kid. But
he's really fun. I've been, enjoying seeing him on Pro Yaku News at night. Although he's a fast talker, and I usually tape Pro Yaku News and I watch it at 1.3 the speed, so that I can get through it quicker than the 58 minute show that it is supposed to be. I can get through it in maybe 50 plus minutes. And I have to slow it down when he's talking because he's such a fast talker.
He's not an old guy, but sometimes he's been on that show. I think all the old guys on Pro Yaki News have kind of infected him.
With what?
He's a little old school. He's a little old school. It's like, well, when I was playing, okay.
Yeah, whatever, dude.
Indeed.
So this draft, it does make for some drama sometimes, and you've got a lot of teams picking one particular player. I was actually pretty shocked last year that a lot of teams didn't try to draft Noki Sasaki. I thought he was going to set a record for teams trying to draft him.
I wasn't surprised, actually. And the reason I wasn't surprised is because he had meetings with all the teams. Mm-hmm. At least he had meetings with 11 teams. I don't think he actually met with the Fighters. But the Fighters were apparently the team he wanted to go to. I think there was an understanding that I think he told the teams that in order to sign him, if he was going to stay in Japan, they would have to promise to post him. And as soon as the Giants and Hawks dropped out, I thought, okay, that's what's going on.
I see. Yeah, those two teams don't post players. So yeah.
Well, they didn't.
They did. Yeah, they did until Shun Yamaguchi got posted. But again, he wasn't someone they had drafted. He was a free agent. They picked up, so they said, "You can go. You can go. Get out of our
made business." Excuses for it. I love it.
And the other thing I do like about the draft that I haven't seen too much recently, but the last player, big name I remember doing it was Tomoyuki Sugano of the Giants, who, when he was drafted by the Fighters, he said, no, thank you. And he sat out a year. Mm-hmm. And this draft system also gives you the option, if you're a player, to say, no, I don't want to sign with that team, because all it does is allow that team to have your draft rights and negotiate a contract. So if you don't want to go, I mean, we have this option in the States as well. I mean, players can go to college, or they can go to junior college or something. But it just seems so much more dramatic here in Japan when a player, especially a high profile player, doesn't accept the contract or doesn't negotiate with the team and decides to sit out a year. In the case of Kosuke Fukudome, play corporate ball and then come back and be drafted in what they call the reverse draft, where
he had that choice of coming back, but nobody, only the Giants drafted Sugano the second time around. So,
of course, right,
Hisayoshi Chono was drafted by the Fighters out of college. And then he didn't want to play for the Fighters, so he went to play corporate league ball. And then he was drafted out of the corporate league ball by the Marines, won him in a lottery. So the Fighters won him in a lottery. The Marines won him in a lottery. And it wasn't until the third time that... So he missed, I think he missed 3 years of eligibility, basically dodging the draft.
Yeah, being a draft dodger, I was going to say. Yeah, but I didn't even remember that now. Now that I recall that. But he wasn't that high profile guy like Sugano, but he was a well known player. So that's another guy. Yep. So it happened. So I like that aspect of the draft too, where guys can say, you know what, no thanks, you know, I'm out of here.
But if we went into a story of shenanigans, this would be we could just have a weekly draft podcast, shenanigans podcast.
That's probably true, but you don't want to hear that. You want to hear the good stuff. So we'll get to our question from Pete. We'll resume that next week, along with another question from Canada. But anyone who has a comment, it doesn't have to be a question. It can be a comment.
And you don't have to all be from Canada. The show is open to everybody.
Hey, the Great White North, indeed, man. We love it. So it looks like we're going to be able to get games in. We're probably going to have to refresh guys on you guys on our picks for the Pacific and Central League. So we'll do that just maybe for the June 15th. Week, we'll just try to go through some of that stuff again. And I don't think I'm going to change, even with a shortened season, I don't think I'm going to change any of my predictions, though I think it does have an impact, but probably not that much. It's only 23 fewer games.
I think it does have an impact, but what that impact is, I haven't the slightest idea.
Yeah, we don't know. I don't know for sure, but I don't think anybody knows, because this is unprecedented. So, but we thank you for listening. We invite you to chime in. Do so via email at yakyujohn@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Leave us a note on the Facebook page. Thank you guys for listening. Take care. Stay safe. Stay inside. And we're going to have a season here in Japan, it looks like. So I can say this with confidence. enjoy your off season because it's going to be over soon.
Right. Okay. We'll see you safe until the season starts.